This is course number four.
Okay.
In our winter program, it's women's issues and men's issues. And we decided that we would start today with a film, simply to kind of emphasize, we hope, what some of those issues are. So, Ray, roll it.
Make sure you don't fall asleep. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, right. And it's right. Just try to keep attentive to the length of this film.
It's only 2 minutes long.
Be lucky to be able to eat a piece before it's over.
Have we ready?
Okay.
Go.
About women's issues and men's issues.
Right? Now can we talk about it? Discussion?
Resource packet. Yeah, Dan had done had picked it up someplace and he put it in the resource packet. And the response. Get down that.
What was the song that they were singing in the background? Something about God the Father.
Rise up, O men of God.
And the last
one was Faith of Our Fathers. They changed it, yes.
Changed what?
Men, rise up, O men of God, to rise up, O saints of God. Did you like the film?
Yeah, it was cute.
do you know Sharon Enzweiler? That's the first time I've ever seen the name.
No.
She's written some... sort of hymn book or something.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of resources for...
Yeah.
Inclusive language stuff.
My sense of the film is that it is just so to the point. You know, and it's so bizarre that it's hard not to argue for inclusive language because of it. But then I'm wondering if that's just a perception that comes out of having worked through this, or, you know, what is...
Maybe we should just say that I think our purpose at this part is just to see if there are any immediate, strong responses, to share those and then to move on to something else. So this is not meant to lead into a long discussion, mm-hmm. but you got to toss them out, and if you don't, we'll move on.
Well, I guess the thing that I thought of is that we, being inside the system, have a real difficulty seeing it unless somebody tells us that that's really how it is. Whereas an outsider comes in learning the language, you know, learns that there's a difference or whatever.
It's like somebody outside the system can see the inconsistencies.
Mm-hmm. And we can't, because we're so caught up in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then the one point where, you know, growing up mankind, and man is used inclusively, but the point that they try to make that father is inclusive mother, I never made that connotation. Mm-hmm. That, ever.
When it's used in our fathers.
Land of our fathers.
No, God the Father.
My experience in the parish was that I got more complaints about using inclusive language than I got statements of support. I didn't get a lot of either, but probably twice as many complaints. Mm.
Do you know why that was?
Why that was? Well, no. I mean, and almost, as I think about it, all the comments were from women, both ways. I can't recall a comment from a man.
Inclusive language as far as men and women, or as far as people who die?
Mostly in terms of men and women, but also in regard to
people will be offended if
you
said females?
Or if I suggested in a verse in a song that we change. Yeah, no one can, you know, if in a sermon nobody said, gee, we should use mankind instead of humankind. But if I would say in verse 4 here, let's say saints instead of men or something. People say, geez, they wrote that hymn. It's been singing that way for 300 years. What's the big deal? We all know it includes both.
And it's a lot just what you get used to hearing, too. Like the word chairman had never bothered me at all. I never even thought about that the man was in there. You know, chairman was just the word that was used to recognize that person in the first place. It's a ridiculous name, a chair man, if you were going to. And so it really bothered me, this chairperson, and now I've heard that enough that I don't pay much attention to that, so it doesn't especially bother me anymore. But for me, it was more just a matter of, you know, hearing something new and then having to think about it and realize that they both were kind of ridiculous. So I didn't call a person a chairperson, or I did just call them a chairperson. But it was, I think, really just the idea of having it brought to your attention so, because it was new and not.
We had a family in our community named Casperson, and they were fairly prominent because I would come across the name all the time. I didn't know them. But then I got so sensitized that every time I saw the name, I always thought, I wonder if their name used to be Casman. Now it's Casperson.
Casperson.
I just thought that constantly.
It's true. When I hear things changed now, in liturgy or in lessons, it's almost like I'm looking for it. And I don't even listen to the message. It's almost like, I see that sun, or I see that. And I lose the focus for a minute. And it bothers me when that happens. I suppose that's because it's relatively new in the last couple of years. Not that I oppose it at all. It's just that it once you're aware, it's kind of bothersome because you see everything that way.
For me, that's a case for maybe changing the liturgy so that it uses, so that it all uses inclusive language. Because if we use, say, raised liturgy, I don't even notice, you know, any references to gender at all. And it's freeing to think of God as genderless instead of having to, like you say, think of using an opposite word or a different word for son or his or he.
The math is ruined for me now. I can't. I really enjoyed seeing it, but I'm so conscious that I'll say the wrong word. That
yeah.
And I can identify with those words. Yeah, I'm just a long while, but it's sort of saying you've been wrong all this time. I make a real distinction between, a real distinction, but I've become much more conscious over the years of sexist language and things like textbooks and schools and this kind of thing, separate from liturgical use. And so I'm much more aware of that, and the first thing I mentioned strikes me as wrong much more than it does in liturgical. Like, I'm not to the place where it has ever been uncomfortable or bothersome for me to think of God as his father, and so on. Now it's that probably will come too, but I'm still real hung up on talking about there, that it makes me lose my focus in just trying to be conscious. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm much more, I suppose the word is accepting of changes in things outside of religious language that still is I had another focus on that earlier as well.
I can very much identify with that too. I can think back to my, I mean, I'm pretty caught up in this stuff, obviously. Otherwise I wouldn't be teaching it and raising it, but I hark back to my high school days and my seminary days, even when the whole Christian faith, I connected with it in some ways. I'd go to worship and get real moved by it and so forth. And now, I have to admit, it's very painful for me not to get caught up in it. It makes me either want to go somewhere else where people are not doing the sexism battle about it. And yet, I guess, not my answer to it, but some sort of thing that helps me reconcile it right now is that anytime we're caught up in, that's where I'm caught up. I'm caught up in the change of the images, and perhaps the faith is working itself out in that, too. I didn't say that as clearly as I wanted to, but there's something that feels important. I mean, maybe religion and relationship to God is not always buying into something. It's working it out too. It's just kind of a personal statement about what's happening. It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable, and it's bothersome. Like you say, I'm sensitive to it all the time, and I want to change other people. It's horrible feelings, but I think I need to accept that in some ways and keep working on that and see where it's going to come out.
This says to me that my view of God is too simplistic, that I go along with this notion of God the Father, not so much God the Creator, regardless of, because it has the connotation to anyone who has a father, of what a father is, as a contrast to a mother. So that's what it says to me.
In one sense, it seems. In one sense, it seems to me we're fighting such a harder battle, because what we're really fighting is a battle of our language. I mean, it isn't just culture. Now, there are languages where you have an indefinite pronoun, and you don't have to go through and change all the hymns to something that we don't, because our language doesn't have it. So we're really trying to change something when we don't have the language to do it, in one sense. So that compounds at least my frustration. And I would be very happy if we were like, well, for instance, we got acquainted with Indonesian, where there is so much easier theologically, because there is a pronoun that can mean both or either. It's terrible not to have one.
That may help focus. The crux of the matter for me is that, is the question that we don't have the language to be inclusive, or is that the question, or is the question that that the system really is male-dominated? That's why we have male language, and that's why male language includes all. And maybe that's a good way into saying, I think that's what the course is about, is to take a look at and stuff like that and find out where that comes from, how we all buy into it just by virtue of being alive in this particular society in this day and age, and see what we want to do with it. Maybe we should move on to the next part, otherwise we might not get through.
I need to go get something to blow my nose. I'll be right back.
Okay. Do you wanna start? Do you wanna do yours? Could you do yours first?
Sure.
Okay. What we've decided to do next, Susan is going to present some of her experience of growing up female, and then I will present some stories from my experience of growing up male, just as kind of a way to kick this all off.
The last time I did this, I dressed for it. This time, I didn't. I was too lazy. But I can see myself already doing. I don't need the clothes to do this. to share my story is to just sort of, I'd kind of like to go back to the beginning of my life, into the family and the time into which I was born, and that is, it was World War II. My mother was the only one of her family, or no, I guess her brother was married too. Was the only one. Those two were the only two to be married, and they were both married to men who were not servicemen, but were Pullman conductors on the railroad, which meant that they were never home. In the meantime, her brothers were off, in one in the Philippines and one in Europe, and my dad is an only child, and so there were no men around in this family into which I was born. And I was born the second daughter. The next year, another sister was born, so that for at least the first 3 years of my life, I had my mother and my grandmothers and my aunts. My grandfathers were around, but they were, oh wait, I don't know where they were. I don't remember them. My first remembrance, first, you know how they always ask, what are the first thing that you think you can remember in your life? And I think the first thing that I remember is the end of the war, when I was about 3.5 or 4 years old, and my uncles came home. And we had all this big, I have a remembrance of this big table with everybody there, and these men that I didn't know, who just teased me and my sisters and scared us in many different ways, because we weren't used to them. We weren't used to the kind of being tossed up in the air and, you know, played with, and, you know, all of this. And yet I grew to love them, and they were good teachers for me in different. One of them taught me how to tie my shoes. I remember him teaching me how to tie my shoes. Also taught me how to cross my eyes.
Really important.
Oh, it was, no. I still see him doing that. Part of the reason, I think, for that, though, as I remember back, is that that my sisters, you're younger than I am, had a wandering eye. And so she had these eye exercises that she had to do with her finger. And so we'd practice doing, you know, strengthen the eye muscles. But then he'd come along and say, do that, but don't do that too much, because your eyes will get crossed and they'll stay. But for the most part, it was a very, very female family, because even after the war, my father was not home a great deal of the time. He was gone on the road. And then he'd come back, and then he'd go to work with his dad, and we never really saw him much. So because there were no boys yet in the family, the process of growing up for me was that there was no gender identity. You know, the first 10 years of my life, I did learn how to cook, and I did learn how to sew, because Grandma taught us how to do all those things. And I did learn how to take care of, you know, babies. My mom had 2 children after I was 8 or 9. She had another daughter, and then when I was 11, she had a son. And so, you know, we learned all of the maternal kinds of the female, traditional female things. But we also had the responsibility for mowing the lawn, shoveling the snow, carrying out the garbage, helping lift furniture or move stuff. You know, I mean, there was never any sense that we couldn't do that. But I remember at about age 11, things changed. And it wasn't the family pressure. It was the external pressure. As you grow up and you get ready for junior high, all of a sudden, I'm hearing another message. The message of don't be too smart. Don't let the boys know how bright you are, because they won't like you. If you want boys to like you, you've got to be cute. If you want them to like you, you can't be too good as an athlete, which was really strange for me, because I was good. But when we were kids and we'd play in the street, this was another thing. We always played in the street. We didn't go to the playground. We had this block where everybody watched out for everybody else. So we would all go out and play ball in the street, but the boys controlled it. And they would always say, all right, you guys go to the outfield, which meant we were halfway down the block. And then when they'd hit the ball down there and we couldn't get it back, they'd say, I don't know why we let you play. You know? And they'd never let us play football. They would only let us play with them when they were playing baseball, because we would chase after the balls. But we had a fairly good rapport, boys and girls, in the neighborhood. We used to do shows, just like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. I tell you, we had crepe paper costumes. My older sister and the neighborhood woman, friend, really coordinated it. One was a dancer and the other one was a pianist. And we did shows. Every summer, and we sold tickets, and we did that. You know, so we had a real diverse kind of relationship. But about 11, this is when my best friend went to junior. She's a year older than I was, and went to junior high. And all of a sudden, she changed. And she's wearing makeup, and she's doing these odd things. I thought they were odd because I was still in grade school. Anyway, we started to learn how to be ladies. You notice how I'm all of a sudden sitting. There were these, it was a literal training process. You learned how to dress, not too flamboyantly. You know, you didn't want to be too noticed, but you had to look neat and you had to look pretty. And you had to learn how to sit so that your legs were together, so that they couldn't look up your skirt. And I never knew what they were going to look up for, but, you know, I mean, those were the messages. There's this learning about your body that you've got to be real careful to protect yourself. You're not even sure at age 11 what you're protecting yourself from, but you learn those things. And so I learned how to sit, how to smile, how to be soft, how to stand. I can still do this. You can stand. You never,
ever look at the chair.
You walk. Your feet pointed. And when you come back, you find the chair with your leg, and you sit. And you cross your legs at the ankles. And this is the way a lady behaves. There were, for me, some very mixed messages in all of this. At home, I was expected to be independent, to learn how to do things for myself. Out there, I was learning how if you do all those things for yourself, then you're not quite a woman. So I went more with the pressure from home, the idea that I could do anything. But I was also told at home to be proud of my height, but not to let anybody know how proud I was. I was taught to learn to take care of myself, but don't be too independent. My mother kept telling me, you're just too independent. My father kept saying, do it yourself. You can do it. There was all of this kind of thing. When my dreams for my future as a child were, one of the goals was to be an actress. I wanted to be a cowgirl. I wanted to be Dale Evans. She was my heroine as a young child. Nancy Drew. All of the books I read, and all this is stuff that I've looked at as I've grown older, all of the books were female books. They were Betsy Tacy, Nancy Drew, Laura Ingalls Wilder. All of the images were there for this. Betsy Tacy? I can hardly. Betsy Tacy, they're upstairs. Oh, and yeah, I graduated to the nurse book. Sue Barton, student nurse. All of these. Who? I didn't read. No, I didn't read those, but. And I may be too young for this. The what?
I'm her generation.
Well, you're only 8 years older than I am, so. Somewhere in there, there's some mixed up. But I never read Tom Sawyer. You know, I wasn't interested in the Hardy Boys.
Zane Grey.
Mm-hmm. You know, so all of these were women who had careers. They always, you know, Nancy Drew in that car. I couldn't wait to grow up and have my own little car and tool around, you know, and just be real independent. And her boyfriend was always. Ned. Nancy would just do her thing, and Ned would sort of come and try to rescue her, but she was usually the one that rescued him. I mean, you know, it was kind of this strange kind of thing. But after, once I got into high school, a lot of the stuff was really ingrained, I think, about not being very self-conscious about my body, very self-conscious about how I behaved in a situation where I might want a boy to like me. And I actually didn't learn a whole lot about flirting until I was older than that. I didn't know how to do that. Well, I decided that there certainly are, yeah. And then once I learned that, it was hard to unlearn it. And it's still hard to unlearn some of those techniques of, it's almost a manipulation to get a male's attention, you know, of, it's hard not to do that. there's sort of an expectation in male-female relationships about games and actions, and from the female standpoint, you know, those are the things I had to learn later. Pantyhose were the most freeing experience for me in terms of my body. Now, those of you who are probably under 30 or 35 even have no idea what I'm talking about, right? But we had these girdles, or garter belts, but we started wearing girdles when we were like 15 years old with the garter things, you know, here. So, but that's why you had to keep your legs together too, because if the skirts were real short, so then they sort of slide up and you'd be embarrassed because you'd see something, your garter belt or
the top of your hose.
The top of your hose, yeah. And But you know, not to be cinched in, to be able to wear nylons without a girdle was wonderful. And all of a sudden this body started to feel, and I think for me there was a real change in terms of how I felt about my body. I wasn't so worried about, you know, I was forever, I was holding my stomach, I'm talking about it, I'm doing it. Holding in my stomach and my rear end so that you look slim and all those things. And that's why we wore the girdle, so we didn't have to do that, I think. Mm-hmm. Learn how to control those muscles. But it was so nice not to have to feel like my whole body was being held in just so that I would be appreciated by the public. The other thing was never wear a blouse that was buttoned down. You know, I wear a lot of turtlenecks. You don't want your body to be shown, so you buttoned everything up for years. We did. You know, we had all those wonderful little Peter Pan collars and stuff. And just the freedom to wear blouses and dresses that were open at the neck, you know, and just have this sense of freedom about who this person is. That did not come to me until the advent of the independence of teaching and the advent of pantyhose. All came together. For me, the struggle in terms of women's, the real crux of getting into the whole feminist movement, the feminist questions, the women's issues came when I started working professionally for the church. I was a public school teacher for 5 years, and yes, there's a hierarchy in the school system. And yes, there is somebody who's in charge, the superintendent, and nobody likes the superintendent. You know, I mean, it's sort of like you don't trust the superintendent because he or she, in some cases, there were. When I grew up, I had a woman principal in my school. I had women teachers in elementary and in secondary. So there wasn't a sense that wasn't, you know, that women couldn't do those things. It's harder for women to be superintendents to get that job. But in Minnesota now, there are two districts that have women superintendents, two fairly large districts. But as a teacher, I was really felt a mutuality among my colleagues. I did not ever feel as if I was considered inferior because I was a female. I was paid the same amount of money as the men, you know, had the same kind of authority in the classroom as they did. You know, so there was never, you know, we used to have just really good times. Then I went to work for the church. And I'll tell you, I thought, it should be reversed. But I worked with male pastors, male church councils, and most often when people saw me at work at the church, they assumed I was a secretary. And there's nothing wrong with being a secretary except that I can't do that very well. I can't tie, I don't have good, I have good hand-eye coordination for athletic kinds of things, you know, have to catch a ball or do that, but I can't type and read at the same time. So I was always making mistakes, typing mistakes and so forth. But that was the assumption. And the other assumption was that the pastor was the authority and that that I was only there to help him do his job. So then there was this whole question about ordination of women. And I thought about it and I thought, well, I think it's a good idea. And this is my confession. I think it's a good idea, but I'm not so sure that I'd want a woman for a pastor. And now I am one. But what it said to me was that it was so ingrained that all the rest of the world could change, but the church had to stay the same. And the church had to stay the same because the Bible says God is a man and all of these kinds of things. So I started to learn to really struggle with that and to explore that, and had one just awful discussion with a pastor one time about his program of evangelism, which dealt with he had 12 disciples, and he'd send these 12 disciples out, and they were all men. Now, here we get into the language thing. I said, why are they all men? Because the Bible says men. It says, you know, and he quoted a text, and I can't remember what it was. I think it was from Ephesians. Quoted a text that definitely we would say was inclusive of women, even though it said men. And he said, see, it says men. So, for me, all of those experiences, and it's still true that as a woman who is now a pastor, I still have to deal with a lot of questions in parishes about being a woman and being a pastor. As a teacher, I would not have to answer those questions. Perhaps as a doctor, even, I would not have to answer those questions. Maybe as an attorney, I might still have to in a courtroom. But the thing about it is that growing up, I had all these fantasies about what I wanted to be, and there was never a fantasy about wanting to be a mother or married. And I just assumed that would happen, I think. But when I was planning out my life, those were not my fantasies. Nor were my fantasies that I would be a doctor or a pastor or an attorney, a detective maybe, or a heroine of some sort. But I wasn't conditioned or raised to think in those terms. And through the pain of trying to be what I think God created me to be is where those issues began to surface. And where when I meet resistance, just simply because of my gender, I really get angry. I mean, if the resistance is because I can't handle the job, that's because I don't have the skills, that's something else. But I really believe that God has called me to the various vocations I've had, and that I have the gifts that are necessary for that, just as men often do. And so that's my story. I don't told it longer this time than last time.
I was wondering if we should have asked people to respond now to that. Thinking that maybe if I said something that mine would become down. Should we do that?
Yeah.
Just curiosity, do you mind sharing at what point the language, from what you said, when you grew up, the language of the church did not bother you, you became conscious of that later, would that be right?
Yeah, sure.
You would be part of this other becoming aware then.
I think I remember, though, even as a teacher, using inclusive language in the classroom, always remembering he or she, not using mankind. Probably using it sometimes, but in general. I had a sense of being inclusive of both boys and girls in the classroom. Young men and women, actually, because I was in high school. But as far as the God language, yeah, that came. It came after I started working for the church. Because it is just so, it to me it feels even evil to hold on to it. It feels demonic. Because I sense a real need to have power over me. That's why I said this morning about obedience. I'm not good at obedience. I'm not good at obedience.
That anger that you've met, resistance because of your gender in the church. I'm wondering if you see that when you first started in the parish, it made you feel really angry and it's gotten better for you, or how is the struggle then as far as the anger you carry or have about that now?
It was interesting for me that the 4 years that I served as a parish pastor, I very seldom confronted, or that anger very seldom surfaced. It's still there, I know that, because it surfaced a lot here. But the experience there was sort of, you know, I was in charge. that was it, you know. And so when people would say, "God, I've never heard a woman pastor before," they'd come to funerals. That was the comment, always. "Never heard a woman pastor before," and I'd say, "Well, how was it?" "Well, you know, I didn't notice any difference." And I said, I kind of thought that's what most people, you know, that's what happens to most people, is that they don't notice any difference. I mean, in terms of, they still hear the word, whether it comes from out of a woman's mouth or out of a man's mouth. So those 4 years were wonderful years for me in terms of, and learning to listen to men in those 4 years. That was really important to me, because I think that as you go through this process, that there's a point at which women also need to listen to where men, what the men's issues are. And I discovered in listening to men who are laborers that that's why it was easier for them to have a woman pastor, I think. In many ways, because they understood the pain that I was talking about. The pain of being oppressed, the pain of being, you know, not counting, of being discounted, especially those who were consistently laid off every 6 months and dangled with a little pink slip kind of thing. So I learned some really good lessons there from them in terms of their pain.
So what's your vision for inclusiveness in church, or how men and women should work together in the church, I guess? I mean, obviously we have to get past the growing pains of anger.
My vision is to, which is just absolutely so idealistic, it's crazy. We need to let go of the hierarchy. We have got to stop this growing, you know, so that we have one person on top and then all these other people all the way down. We have to learn how to do consensus decision making. And so that's my idea, is that we live in consensus.
I'm curious, as at the district or whatever the level was, fellow pastors, did you give them a personal exception?
No. The only time I ever insist on wearing my clerical collar is when I'm with clergy.
I was curious about that because The little church I belong to, they're very open and there's a woman president and all of that. But just make a suggestion and they can be discussing the thing for 15 minutes and make a suggestion, and some man is going to have an answer, and they, you know, is going to...
That's been your experience.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel? What happens to you?
Well, what happened to me in this particular instance, it was a case where they had rented a copier or whatever for 6 months, and they had to decide whether to continue renting or buy it. And they talked on and on and on and on. And I finally said, you know, sometimes it's good to rent, because that way you update later on and so on, you know, that from a firm that paid off. And right away, a banker got up and said, "Well, this isn't a business. We don't really have to stay up to date today." And the guy that keeps himself, his family on the most got the main motion that we rented. And here they have been. I think that the president would have had to finally say, "We've got to vote." But just like that, me talking went. And right off the bat, I recognized it as a male-female thing. But you see, it didn't matter to me if they rented it or they bought it. I didn't really care.
But what bothered you was the way in which the decision got made.
Yeah, because it's just like if they slapped me. It was that fast reaction, and they had been. You know how they can draw out, I'm sure, those meetings.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how hard the president tries to get things done. And that's what they were doing. They weren't ready to make a decision at all. But I forced the issue right off the bat. Working the just opposite of what that one is. Yes.
Yeah.
Because that's okay. I can do those things and look at it and think, it's okay to stick my neck out. It's okay.
It's just good. Yeah. I think that there's some pain in that, though.
I have a real good rapport with this man that made the motion, but his wife don't hardly hear to breathe without me, and she's a biochemist. don't know how she got in that spot, you know.
Well, it's okay as long as she does her job.
They have a good relationship, and that's fine.
My mother, well, that's something else I was going to share, is my mother doesn't drive. And until about a year and a half ago, I'd never written a check. Mm-hmm. And she finally said to us, she announced at one of our family meals gatherings, I wrote a check. Now, will you all relax? Our major concern is that if something were to happen to our father, that she would have a very difficult time getting all that stuff together. So she's not worried about it. Maybe we shouldn't either. It's been fun to watch the change in them. Watching my mother assert herself more as her daughters have grown older and have become more. I have three sisters who are married. Three of my sisters are married, and all three of them work outside the home. All three of them have children. And the oldest sister didn't start working outside the home till her children were teenagers or college age, and then they needed money, and that was the reason why she started. But she just loves it. She and her husband have, their marriage has just blossomed in this child, you know, the empty nest syndrome. Their relationship has grown in a whole new way, and it's really exciting to watch. But it's also been fun to watch my parents. My dad battled for the power he used to have. Can't understand where it went. And he's not real comfortable with it, but they have grown a great deal. Anybody who says you can't change when you're older are crazy, because they have. I've watched, and that's been good to see. It is, you know, it really is. They've had to face a lot of interesting things. I mean, they've had to face alcoholism in a brother, a divorce, which that was unheard of in the family until some cousins were all divorced. They had to face prison. One of my relatives spent 6 months in prison for embezzlement. They have their best friend's son married a woman who's black. I mean, now that doesn't seem too unusual to us, but to them it was a traumatic experience. My brother is gay. And what else? Their daughter is a pastor, and right, that's it. Their daughter's a pastor. And so then, and their friends are all dying.
It interests me how this kind of thing affects people differently. That kind of fascinates me. We are terribly different in age. Mm-hmm. Considered in the same generation. And when the feminist movement first came along, it was sort of like to me, but I have never known discrimination because, I mean, that was my feeling, and yet I have. Mm-hmm. I think even when I first started teaching school, I know I was on a different salary scale. I can't remember if it was because I was a woman or because I was single. Or maybe both.
In elementary and high school, you were in elementary.
Oh, but there was a double.
Oh.
There was also, if I was single and a woman, which tended to go together as elementary too.
That's right.
I was on a different salary scale. But why didn't bother me? That's what fascinates me. And when I went overseas, in fact, when I left overseas, I was still on a different salary scale for being single. And yet somehow that had just always kind of seemed appropriate to me, because it was true, those same people did need more than I did then. But I grew up very, a very traditional, conservative farm family, and yet very independent. There were three girls and one boy. I milked the cows every bit as much as my brother did. In fact, it did bother me when I was young. I did all the outside things and loved it. And also had to do all the inside things. My brother did all the outside things, but didn't have to do all
that's
things.
Right.
And
yeah.
That didn't bother.
Yeah.
But still, I never grew with my parents have always accepted. I mean, they haven't been all hung up in the fact that I wasn't married, but probably more than just accepted.
Your mother's going to be so happy. Yeah.
I have a sister-in-law who was hung up on it. She used to write and read in these letters to McGinney, and she would always have questions like, now what's the man situation like over there? So one holiday in June was able to get in and was visiting me. And I was in the Highlands, and where my neighbors, as they walked through the yard, were often their guineas wearing leaves with their bodies smeared with pig grease, wearing a boar's tusk through the exception of their nose and with all their feathers and so on. And so as one walked through the yard one day, June took a picture
God,
of me
just
standing beside him. I sat at home and I said, this is the situation. And a lot of years, I've not ever
That's
heard
right.
another
It's okay to be single.
Just in the more recent years when we came home and we were asked to have this service in our congregation in Bucyrus, Ohio, mm-hmm. after the service, this elderly German pastor who had been a pastor and had retired and spoke with his wheelchair accent reminded me of what you were talking about. He came up afterwards, all congratulatory, and he says, why? That was as good as a man.
That's right. Yep, the ultimate complimentary.
And so there's some of these things that can, should I say, really upset me now, but for some reason they didn't on a personal level. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Maybe because you don't work with other people.
Well, and I wonder if being overseas, you know, in a different culture, yeah. and having to struggle even there with their structural differences.
That this being a lesson.
Yeah.
So many other struggles.
Yeah, and I feel sometimes that this is, I mean, I'm so tired of this struggle because there are so other ones that are so much more worldly. But I keep being prevented from getting at those struggles because I don't have any power. The other comment is, that's not bad for a woman. I've heard that.
Yeah.
You're not bad for a woman.
Sounds like me and Liz. Not bad. Can't complain.
Pretty good job for a woman. And I never know how to respond to that. I can't, you know, sometimes I find myself saying thank you and I think, wait a minute. I said thank you to that, what, you know. Am I supposed to be grateful for that kind of? Oh, I don't know.
I found a lot of pain in it too, though. It's a lack of support for me.
Yeah.
I mean, while I've gotten a lot of support, the other side of that, and not so much support from men, the other side of that is I've gotten a lot of support from men, and no reinforcement. Or even affirmation that I feel pain. That why do you feel why should you feel that way? And not even willing to affirm that you have pain and that whether or not you know that other person feels the pain or not. It's a lot. And
that hurts. Yeah. I don't know. Does anybody have a response? Yeah. We're also taught to be competitive with each other, not to trust each other. You know, the pain of growing up a female and not being as attractive as your best friend, you know, and knowing that the minute a boy asks her out, and you have, maybe we had plans to go to a show, and she gets asked out on a date, she goes. And you just learn that some of the things that you learn about that is we don't commit ourselves to each other because our primary goal is to get a man. And then, once you've got one, hold on to him. And the best way to hold on to him is not to recognize any of the pain that maybe being in that relationship is causing. So don't tell me about your pain because I think I know about it, but I don't, you know. But then that'll disturb my relationship with this man, and I can't live without him. I think we get a lot of support from women who are in good relationships with men, who have, you know, who have an opportunity to share their pain with their husbands or friends, lovers, but from those who are so afraid of breaking a pattern because they're so afraid of what's going to happen to them. They don't want to hear it.